Okay, it's 3 o'clock, time to get started. So I want to welcome everyone this afternoon to the 2020 Postdoctoral Awards for Research Excellence. Each year, these cash awards are given in recognition of the research promise demonstrated by individual postdoctoral scholars. The awards are open to scholars in all disciplines and are designed to support their professional growth. This year, there are 5 awardees, each of whom will provide a brief presentation on their research activity. Joyce Tan, who is serving as Director of the Office of Postdoctoral Affairs, she will introduce each of the awardees as they give their talks. So congratulations to all of you and welcome. And I'm looking forward to hearing your talks. Joyce?
Yep. Great. Thanks, Terry. I'm going to do a quick share here. And just wanted to again congratulate our Part Award winners. Our winners this year are Catherine Gunn from Biochemistry and Biophysics, Hujiang Song from the Department of Ophthalmology, Carol Murray from the School of Law, Dashira Wallace from the School of Public Health and Health Behavior, and Margot Wettendorf from the Department of Cell Biology and Physiology. So as Terry said, we're gonna have each of our postdoctoral fellows give a 5-minute presentation, and we will have about 3 minutes or so to give for questions right after each of the presentations. And so please go ahead and, as you have questions, put them into the Q&A box that's found at the bottom of the of your Zoom window. And I'll read out the questions as we get them after the speakers have finished talking. Okay, and so with that, we're gonna get started. So our first speaker is Catherine Gunn. Catherine is a postdoc in the Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics in the School of Medicine. She's a recipient of the American Heart Association Postdoctoral Fellowship. Catherine came to UNC from Northwestern University, and that's where she received her doctoral degree. At UNC, Catherine is combining and using different techniques in structural biology, molecular biology, microscopy, and computational science to make important discoveries about lipoprotein lipase, which is a protein that is crucial for the regulation of metabolism. So Catherine's really combining a lot of different sort of interdisciplinary work in her own work. So that's really exciting to see. So Catherine, please go ahead.
Hi, thank you, Joyce. And also, I'd like to thank the PAR Award Committee for choosing me to share my research with you guys today. And as Joyce mentioned, I have a deep interest in protein structure and mechanism. And one of the things that I've been lucky enough to do since I've come to my postdoc here at UNC is learn the technique called cryo-electron microscopy, or cryo-EM. So this is a technique where you actually freeze proteins into really thin sheets of ice and then take thousands and thousands of pictures of them. And then you can actually computationally average these pictures together and solve a 3D structure of the protein. And so this is really great because it gives us another way to solve protein structures. And then that allows me to get at questions of mechanism that I find interesting. And so as Joyce mentioned, I've been applying this most recently to study a protein of interest in the NIR lab called lipoprotein lipase, which we also abbreviate as LPL. And so LPL might not be a protein that you've heard of before, but it's actually very important. And it's a protein that removes fat from the blood. And this is really important because if you have a high level of fat in the blood, that can be a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And cardiovascular disease can lead to heart attack and stroke, and obviously it's something that we'd prefer to avoid. So you can actually physically see the difference that having LPL makes in the blood. So if you look here on the left, you see a sample from a patient that is LPL deficient. And what you can see here is that the serum starts to take on an opaque and almost milky-like appearance. And this is actually due to the fat buildup in the blood. And then here on the right, you can see what serum from a patient with a regular amount of LPL would look like. And so if you can imagine, if you have this fat clogging things up, that can be very bad for your heart health. And so we wanted to know more about lipoprotein lipase, so we decided to study it using cryo-EM. And we made a really interesting discovery, which is that LPL can actually form tubes of protein. And so what I mean by that is that each LPL subunit can come together and create this lattice-like structure that forms a tube. And so when we investigated this, we found that this is an inactive form of LPL and that it's actually really stable. And so when we think about where you would want an inactive and really stable form of LPL in your cells, we realized that this would actually be a really good way to store LPL in your cells before you release it out into the blood. And so to see if this is what was happening, I worked with a graduate student in the lab called Ben Roberts, who helps me get some super resolution microscopy images of LPL in cells. And so if you look into a cell and you fluorescently label the LPL, and then you look into a cell storage compartment, you actually see that the LPL is forming a ring-like structure. And this ring-like structure is the tubes of LPL going around the sides of the storage compartment. And just to confirm that these were in fact the tubes of LPL that we had seen, we created a type of LPL that could no longer form tubes. And when we look at those LPL in cells, you can see that the storage compartments no longer have these ring-like structures of LPL, and instead the LPL is spread throughout the storage compartment. And so if we take all of this information and put it together, we were able to come up with a new model for how LPL is stored in cells. And so after your cell makes LPL, it wants to store it instead of releasing it immediately. And so what it can do is it can make these LPL into these really beautiful LPL tubes that are inactive and very stable. And it can keep them in its cell storage compartments until a signal for LPL arrives. So for example, maybe you went and had a donut and now you're having a little bit of extra fat in the blood and your cell and your blood is and your body is sending the signal to say, oh, we need some LPL. Well, now there's a pool of LPL that's ready to be secreted out into the blood where it can go ahead and help digest that fat. And so with that, I would just like to thank my lab, in particular, my mentor, Saskia Neer, and Ben Roberts, who did the microscopy, and also the American Heart Association for my funding. Thank you.
Great, thanks, Catherine. That was a really great talk. If you have audience have any questions, please go ahead and put them in the Q&A and I can read them out. But I can maybe start with the first question. Catherine, can you talk a bit about what happens when LPL gets out to the surface? And so it looks like in the picture that you see it disassembling. And so what is the mechanism, or how do you think how that's occurring when that happens?
So it's actually more complex than that picture made it look like, which is not surprising, I suppose, given our bodies. But what happens is that the LPL comes out of the cells it's made in, and it goes into the space that's in between in between the capillaries and the cells. And so in this interstitial space, it's actually picked up by a partner protein that helps shuttle it into the capillary. And so it's actually basically going to be moved into another onto another type of cell and then into the capillary.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's interesting. So we have a question from Karina. A question is, what is the importance of LPL for the body?
Well, so it's very important because it's working on these large, fat lipoproteins, and it's hydrolyzing the free fatty acids out of them. And this is actually a way of either storing the energy, so you're storing some of the energy in your adipose tissue, or it's also a way of providing energy into your oxidative tissues so that you can use it for energy when you're in a period of fasting. So it's basically, in addition to providing a sort of a heart healthy clearing of the fat, it's using it to provide energy and then, or store energy for future use.
Great. Okay, I'm gonna ask one more question. So Heather, can you talk about sort of these, the use of changes in structure for regulation of proteins, and if there are other sort of models or other proteins that sort of do similar things using this type of mechanism for control?
Yeah, so there are actually other proteins that use the formation of tubes to help regulate their activity. In some cases, you actually find ones that have increased activity when they form into multi-subunit oligomers. But it's also been found to be ones like our protein where it actually, when it forms into the helix or into this tube, it's no longer going to be as active. And this is thought, this is sort of a field that's being, it's growing. And so one of the things that people have started to realize about it is it may actually be in response to nutritional cues, in the sense of if you have an enzyme that works on a specific, you know, substrate, and that substrate is scarce, then you may find that the enzyme is not forming a tube because it's going to want to be active. But if there is, you don't, there's no need for the enzyme to be active, then it forms the tube and it's inactive. So it's really a interesting way of regulating proteins.
Yeah, that's totally fascinating. So one last question from Karina, then we'll move on to our next speaker. Are they, is LPL associated with weight loss in any way?
So the LPL itself is not, I think, associated with weight loss. There has been some studies that show if you can keep LPL active all the time, then you can see weight loss. So what I mean by that is LPL isn't always active in your cell, in your blood. It it kind of depends on whether you're feeding or fasting, which, you know, makes sense. You don't want to have it going all the time. But if you can keep the LPL from being turned off, then they have shown that there has actually been a phenotype of reduced weight. But I should say that's in mice. So it's not been studied in humans.
Great. Well, thanks, Carolyn. That was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move next to Carell Murray. So Carell is a fellow in the School of Law and a scholar in the Carolina Postdoctoral Program for Faculty Diversity. He's a graduate of Stanford Law School, and he has clerked for two federal judges and served as a fellow at the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund. Carell at UNC has been focusing on two major items during his fellowship here. He has written a successful law review article titled Populist Prosecutorial Nullification, which will be published in the New York University Law Review. And this is one of the top journals in the country for legal publications. And Carell will be talking a bit more about that during his presentation. He has also created an intensive writing seminar on race in the law, in the School of Law. Carell was also recently admitted to the Duke Law's Emerging Scholars Program, which is a really selective program that prepares promising scholars for careers as a full-time faculty. So Carell, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. And thank you everyone for being here today. And thank you to the committee for this great honor. So as was mentioned, my name is Carell Murray and I'm a fellow in the School of Law. And I work in the areas of law and democracy, constitutional law, race in the law, and local government law, with a particular interest in how extra-legal principles like power shape our evaluation and creation of legal institutions. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that. How, for example, can legal thinkers account for the ways in which formal political equality can be thwarted by uneven distributions of real financial and political influence? How might legal rules best account for the discretion and the control over outcome inherent in the execution of legal rules? Indeed, is it even useful to call upon an essentially contested concept like power, which can mean by turns different things for different actors in different contexts? All of my areas of interest fall within the broader category called public law, which, to oversimplify, deals with the relationship of the state to the people as opposed to relationships between people. Within public law, notions like democracy, representation, and accountability are often invoked. But difficult questions like the ones I just flagged lurk behind those facially uncontroversial concepts. My scholarship thus attempts to grapple with those problems in the context of concrete legal questions rather than as theoretical abstractions. I thus highlight the salience of value judgments to legal prescriptions. I accordingly train attention on how and how much law can address our pluralistic society's deep differences of opinion on fundamental questions. My recent work has considered novel applications of localism as one means to that end. My work also grapples with how law confronts extra-legal obstacles, such as bad faith actors, evasion, and camouflage discrimination. In my remaining time, I want to talk about how my most recent project and my current project explore those themes. My recently completed project, Populist Prosecutorial Nullification, engaged criminal law on the ground. In recent years, some candidates for district attorney positions have run on promises never to enforce certain crimes or penalties, ranging from prostitution and recreational drug offenses to the death penalty. It's actually true and generally accepted that prosecutors may sometimes decline to prosecute despite factual guilt, at least when this would conserve resources or advance case-specific fairness. But at least to some minds, categorical non-enforcement promises like the ones I just mentioned present a different, more dubious animal. If legitimate, these electoral promises could have dramatic consequences. Most American criminal law is state law, and elected district attorneys enforce most of it. In this piece, I crafted a normative analysis of this trend with particular focus on the import of the locally elected status of the state prosecutors who make these pledges. My framework drew on a localized version of a democratic vision centered on popular sovereignty. I concluded that, under the right circumstances, we can justify in distinctly democratic terms an elected prosecutor who can claim popular sanction for her categorical negation of otherwise applicable state law. Indeed, this, what I call populist prosecutorial nullification, fits within a long tradition of local control over non-enforcement, such as jury nullification, offers similar self-determination benefits to that long trend, and offers improved safeguards against the downsides of populism. In brief, when the prosecutor ties her categorical nullification to her polity's electorally divined will, she accomplishes wholesale what nullifying juries could do retail. I'm currently working on a project titled Tainted Intent, where my goal is to outline a richer account of the ways in which past discrimination can impugn the validity of later, apparently lawful government action. History is context, and courts generally agree that context matters. But a certain kind of historical context has been under-theorized. Some government acts are distinctive not because, or at least not just because, of their own content or contemporary context, but because of their relationship with past discrete discriminatory government acts. Courts have detected and treated those types of relationships inconsistently. Therefore, the goal of the paper is to theorize this relationship in a more detailed way under the name discriminatory taint. The concept, properly understood, will appropriately problematize certain government acts of policy modification or replacement and justify stricter judicial review in cases where a highly deferential test would otherwise apply. Governments should be able to adjust their policies, but not in ways that maintain the taint of previous discrimination or in ways that help cloak pretextual discrimination. Our law, I will argue, should detect such taint in a rigorous way and offer a neutral way to ensure its eradication. I thus close with a targeted rethinking of conventional discrimination law in this context that I suggest improves upon the doctrinal status quo. I'm happy to talk about any of those projects or some of the overarching themes that I mentioned. Thank you.
Thank you, Karel. Really fascinating. So we have two questions. So we'll start with David White's question. Did you conclude that the categorical promise not to prosecute trends differently along racial lines of any kind?
Yeah, so thanks for that question. So it depends on what the trend you were talking about would be. So you might mean, are these promises made differently by prosecutors depending on the prosecutor's race? Or you might mean, are we seeing these promises made in different ways depending on the race of the localities the prosecutors are coming from? So, you know, the first one is a little unclear because the phenomenon is sort of budding and evolving. I do think there's a bit we can say about the first part of that question based on how I'm going to answer the second part of the question. So one useful thing about this entire framework is that it offers a certain degree of self-determination to localities, where localities are situated within a broader state that for whatever reason is not attending to that locality's interests. So for example, you might imagine a locality that has a particular view of the harmfulness or lack thereof of marijuana possession, and a broader state that is either ambivalent or is actively supportive of the enforcement of marijuana possession laws in that jurisdiction. So on my framework, that jurisdiction that I just mentioned is able to extricate itself from that situation by electing a prosecutor who makes that sort of promise. Now, those situations often, although not logically necessarily, arise in cities that are situated within broader states. And as we know, often cities, the racial makeup of cities can be different from the racial makeup of broader states. So of course, we can see this in sort of Chicago. Chicago elects its prosecutor, you might see this sort of trend and promise made in that situation. So the answer, broadly speaking, is not necessarily. However, the way in which it works may end up having these sorts of effects because of the background racial segregation in this country.
Thanks, Corral. Okay, we're now gonna go to a question from Don Hobart. What legal or constitutional checks and balances apply or should apply to a power like categorical prosecutorial nullification? Should it be treated like jury nullification or is it different? Practically, how should a constitutional government regulate a power like that?
Yeah, so there are clearly some disanalogies between jury nullification and the populist prosecutorial nullification that I talk about here. You know, one important difference, and I don't have time to talk about all of them, but one important difference, of course, is the transparency, right? Juries need not ever say anything about why they reached their decision. Conversely, on my model, the prosecutor who is going to invoke this framework does need to announce their promise in a way that is cognizable before the election. So that's one important difference. And I think that leads into the last part of your question, which is how should a government regulate a power like that? Requiring transparency does mean that state, broader state, and federal actors will be aware of the policy, of course. And as your question may indicate, that you know, states retain very broad power to overrule and limit the actions of their localities. So if, as I go into more detail in the paper, the policy in question is either infringing upon the self-determination rights of neighboring jurisdictions, or the policy in question is contravening a particular constitutional guarantee that is sort of a guarantee that the broader state and federal governments have a compelling interest in seeing enforced, those would be circumstances when those governments, either the state or the federal government, could have an interest in regulating, i.e. limiting the exercise of that discretion.
Great, thanks, Grell. So I think we've run out of time for questions. Actually, there are a couple more questions for you, but so maybe I'll save it and then and I'll sort of send it over to Grell and you can answer them to the to some of the individuals. But thank you, that was really fascinating. Okay, so our next speaker is Lu Zhang Song. She is Lu Zhang is a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Ophthalmology in the School of Medicine, and she is also affiliated with the Gene Therapy Center. Lu Zhang received her doctorate in a joint program from Central South University in China and the University of Florida. At UNC, Lu Zhang has been working in Matt Hirsch's gene therapy program, developing AAV gene therapy to treat eye disease, and also designing gene therapy vectors to improve efficiency and safety. She's published more than 10 publications while at UNC, five of which are first author papers, and was awarded the Pfizer NC Biotech Distinguished Postdoctoral Award in gene therapy. So Lu Zhang, please go ahead.
Sorry, I just muted myself. So in 2017, I relocated from the University of Utah to UNC and began my exploration of the AAV-based gene therapy for the treatment of anterior eye diseases. So I guess most of you may not be in the field of gene therapy. So here I wanted to give you a very brief introduction. Basically, there are several critical components when we do the gene therapy research. And one of the most important elements is the vector, because a vector is like a truck that helps you to deliver a package to your home. So just like we have different choices to deliver our package, such as FedEx or UPS or USPS, for gene therapy, we have a lot of different vectors to deliver our therapeutic gene. And what I have been using is a viral vector called adeno-associated virus, AAV. AAV-mediated gene therapy is currently one of the most promising methods for a lot of diseases, especially for eye disease. So here I give a list. All these eye disease I listed here have clinical trials going on, which is great. However, all those diseases I listed here are mostly retinal disease, which is located at the back of the eye. And here I give another list here. Most of these diseases are corneal disease, which is at the very front of our eye. Corneal diseases is also a leading cause for the blindness. However, so far, there is no AAV clinical trial for any of these diseases. So it is relatively an immature area within the AAV community. And this is what our group has been working on. So basically, my research focus at UNC is to elucidate the biology of AAV and use that knowledge to advance the AAV-mediated gene therapy for the treatment of corneal and other anterior eye diseases. So initially, I performed a serotype survey for the AAV to deliver the gene while subcontractile injection. Basically, what I have done was very simple. I just inject different AAV serotypes into the subcontractile space. And then I characterize the transgene expression pattern for each of the serotypes. So for example, as you can see from here, the corneal and the fingernail was successfully transduced by the AAV6 vectors. That's why it is green. So which indicates if our targeted disease is affecting the corneal and the fingernail, then AAV6 might be a perfect serotype to deliver our therapeutic gene. So this work provided the basis for the use of AAV vectors to treat multiple anterior ocular diseases. And it was published in Gene Therapy in 2018. And luckily, it was featured as the journal cover story. In a separate study, our group investigated the therapeutic efficacy of an AAV-mediated gene therapy for the MPS1 corneal blindness. Our data in a canine disease model demonstrated that the AAV-IDUA could prevent and reverse the MPS1 corneal blindness. As you may see from this image, the left eye was treated with AAV-IDUA. So the cornea is clear, but the right eye here was not treated. So it is really cloudy and it is a blinding eye. So after confirming this therapeutic effect in the canine model, I followed this work with a toxicity study in the rabbit. So in this study, we observed basically no obvious and worse effect using the AAV-IDUA vectors. This work added some critical data required for the initiation of a phase one clinical trial. And again, all this work has been published and the work in the canine model was featured as the journal cover story. So in addition to the disease-oriented research, I'm also investigating the mechanistic ways to enhance the AAV gene therapy efficacy and safety. So for example, I recently studied the AAV mobilization risk. I think there will not be enough time for me to go into too much details here. So basically, our data highlights the need for mobilization-resistant vectors and the better vector production systems to maximally ensure the gene therapy safety. So this work was recently published in Human Gene Therapy, and was chosen by the editors of the cover story. So within that, I want to thank you again for your attention and thank the review committee to give me this award. Also, I want to thank my mentor, Dr. Hirsch, and all my mentors for their support and help. It is an absolute pleasure working with all these awesome people, and it is my great pleasure working at UNC. Yeah, that is, I think. I will take any questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thanks, John. That was a great talk. We do have a question here in the Q&A. What could be some of the challenges associated with using AAV vectors in targeting human diseases?
Thank you for the question. So as I mentioned earlier, AAV was considered as a kind of an awesome vector for a lot of diseases. But actually the truth is we all know that nothing is really perfect. So, you know, one of the major limits for the AAV, for the application of AAV is the AAV has really like relatively very small capacity. So, you know, AAV is really a small virus. The diameter of the AAV is like about maybe 20 to 25 nanometer. So its total capacity is only about maybe 4.5, 4.6 kb. So if a disease, the therapeutic gene is like much larger than this, then AAV might not be an ideal vector for that. And you know, in a lot of cases, another disadvantage of AAV vector is like there is a high prevalence of AAV neutralized antibody in our human population. So for example, it was reported that like in the general human population, maybe 80% of us actually was previously infected by wild type AAV virus. So which means like most of us in our body, we already have neutralizing antibody. So for patients who have the neutralizing antibody, they will have to be excluded from the treatment of AAV because it is really challenging for now. And there are also some other challenges related to AAV, such as the humoral immune response after deliver the AAV. There are a lot of challenges as well, although it's really a great vector for a lot of diseases.
Lujan, I'll just follow up with this real quick question about the AAV, followed by AAV vectors. So on your work with the treatment of MPS, for the vectors that you are using, do you need to target those specific tissues, you know, within the eye, or, you know, is that something that you're working on, or is that necessary for this particular treatment?
Yeah, for a lot of disease, actually, we need to target the specific tissue, which it is specifically affected. And for the MPS1, actually it is a systematic disease. So it affects a lot of organs. And for our treatment, we specifically target the eye. So first thing, we do the local injection directly or the administrate our vector into the eye. And another thing we do is we usually use a specific, like tissue specific promoter to restrict the transgene expression. But for this specific case for MPS1, when we do this study, we don't really do a tissue-specific promoter because the IDU enzyme, which is lacking in the patient, it is lacking in most of the other tissues. So.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thanks, Lujan.
We will
move to our next speaker. Thank you for the really interesting talk. Okay, next speaker is Tashira Wallace. So Tashira is from the Department of Health Behavior and the Gilling School of Global Public Health. She's also affiliated with the Carolina Population Center, and she is also a scholar in the Carolina Postdoctoral Program in Faculty Diversity. So Tashira earned her doctorate degree here from UNC, and she has, of course, continued to stay here, and we're happy to see that she decided to stay here longer, working with her mentors, Claire Barrington and Alison Ariello, to focus on health disparity to improve chronic disease management within the Latino and Latin American community. The show has focused a lot of her work with communities in the Dominican Republic, studying the role of stressors and diabetes. And she will be talking more about that today. Tashira, please go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Tan. Let me go ahead and share my screen. And share it. Okay. So, good afternoon, everyone, panelists and attendees. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to present some about my work. So I am Tashira Wallace, and I'm Department of Health Behavior, and my larger research is really focused on understanding kind of psychosocial, including stress, behavioral, and some biological. I'm adding in some biological mechanisms to understand chronic disease prevention and management and some of the disparities we see both between groups and within groups, such as Latinos in the United States and Latin Americans. And my particular group of interest is Black Latinos and understanding some of the disparities within that group. But I'm going to be presenting on one study focused on the Dominican Republic. And the reason Dominican Republic is a very interesting place to study diabetes is because type 2 diabetes burden is growing there. It's a high prevalence of type 2 diabetes compared to the global average, and the Caribbean in general has a higher burden of type 2 diabetes compared to other parts of the world. And to manage type 2 diabetes, there are various facets to it. It includes engagement and self-management behaviors. That includes diet, exercise, taking your medication if it's prescribed as prescribed. It also requires consistent access to healthcare because you do need to check your blood sugars pretty often and things like cholesterol and other factors that can impact your blood sugars. In addition, it does include access to some level of social support. That could be from physicians and your clinical team, that could be from family members and friends to generally help you better engage in these required or recommended self-management behaviors. However, studies have shown, and studies that we've done in the Dominican Republic over the past 5 years have really highlighted that stress has really been linked to worsening type 2 diabetes outcomes because they can impact engagement in various self-management behaviors. They can also, stress can be something related to whether or not people have access to healthcare, and it can be sometimes coming from what people consider low social support from others in their family, friends, or even their care team. So one of the studies that we've been working on during my postdoc time is really understanding diabetes-related stress. It's one type of stress, and it focuses really on what are the like daily hassles or the hassles related to managing your type 2 diabetes. And that can come from family, friends, your care team, your own self-management. And one of the interesting things about diabetes-related stress is it can be a measure using a proxy measure, a 17-item scale called the Diabetes Distress Scale. And so it'd be great to apply it in the Dominican Republic. But the problem is that it's not valid in Dominican populations. And that could add in some bias. So that could mean that people who, if you have this scale and you're working with the Dominican population, they may not either understand some of the questions, even though it's in Spanish and it's been valid in other Spanish-speaking countries. It just may not work exactly the way you think it could work. So that introduces bias that can inadvertently add some changes to what your outcomes are. So the first part of this study was I went down to the Dominican Republic in a rural area that we've collaborated with for the past 5 years from February to March 2020. And I conducted 20 cognitive interviews to determine how these 17 questions would they change, and if they need to be changed, how could they be changed so that they better reflect the how Dominicans understand and think about speaking about their type 2 diabetes and stress. And what I found were that several items needed to be adapted to improve comprehension and reduce bias. That included changing some phrases and also included even changing some of the questions so that they actually parsed out some of the questions asked multiple things at once. For example, asking about social support from friends and family. And I was realizing during the interview process or the discussion process that people were only answering part of the question or would say like, I get support from family, nothing from friends or some from friends, nothing from family, but they wouldn't necessarily average that together to answer the question based on the Likert scale response. So thinking about, do we need to separate some of these questions as well, was something that came up again and again. So for the next steps, once I finish adapting the scale using from the cognitive interviews, I'm going to conduct a cross-sectional study to apply this scale of the adapted diabetes distress scale. And that will include distributing this questionnaire that includes the diabetes distress scale to about 900 adults living with type 2 diabetes in rural areas of the Dominican Republic. The questionnaire will also include a depression scale, anxiety scale, and a general stress scale. That's because based on our qualitative interviews over the years, these have also emerged as important factors to consider. And also I want to double check that what I'm capturing is diabetes distress and not something else like general stress. In addition, this is an older population. So one of my mentors was speaking about maybe thinking about cognition and thinking about how cognition can change, especially thinking about the average age of the population we'd be targeting is about 56. And so cognition and type 2 diabetes, there have been studies that linked those. And so probably adding a cognition question. And then I'm in a rural area and food insecurity has come up again and again in some of the interviews. So adding a food insecurity scale. We'll also combine this questionnaire with the clinical measures that we already have access to from the medical records, including blood pressure, blood glucose, lipids, height, and weight. So I would like to thank my funding and institutional support from the Caroline Postdoctoral Program for Faculty Diversity, the Caroline Population Center, the Population Science Training Program, my mentors, Drs. Clara Barrington and Allison Aiello, and the chair of the Department of Health Behavior, Dr. Kurt Rubisill. And thank you. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Great, thanks, Dashira. So if you do have questions, please go ahead and type them in the Q&A box, but I can get us started. Could you talk about what you expect some of the results will be once you complete your data collection?
Sure, so wasn't able to get into some of the context. So the population that we have access to and we've collaborated with over the years, they have access to a diabetes and hypertension clinic specifically. So they have access to free diabetes related and hypertension medical care and metformin and those types of medications, and also work with community health workers who can give them health education. So one of the questions is, if we apply the scale, because they already have access to these various structural things that end up causing people stress when managing a chronic condition, will that depress the level or the prevalence of something like diabetes distress? I don't know, but I do, in some ways I don't know, but based on the qualitative interviews we've done over time and some of the observations we've done in the clinic, I do feel like while they do have access to this, there's some larger issues that aren't being addressed. And that includes things like food insecurity, that includes like social support, both in the home and outside the home. So I do think that there are gonna be various domains of stress that will still emerge as being particularly high. Or if you don't have a great relationship with your provider, patient provider communication is one of those aspects and domains of stress in the diabetes distress scale. And it still can end up showcasing pretty highly. So I think it still could be, I don't anticipate it being particularly low, but it would be a great, you know, first thing to think through once we apply it.
So I want to just follow up on the you know, what your thoughts are on the food insecurity issue. So, you know, what are some of the major differences that you've seen or found in the Dominican Republic community compared to the US or, you know, more some of Western European communities on food insecurity? You know, because there's some, you know, surprises, right? But as far as sort of in the United States, that actually obesity is found in sort of poorer populations because access to fast food is actually easier here. So what have you found in the Dominican Republic in that sense of about food and how that may affect chronic conditions like diabetes?
Yeah, sure. So food insecurity is pretty interesting also because I think if I was thinking about an urban area, access to a lot of fast foods in the Dominican Republic is also, it's pretty prevalent in Latin America and a lot of different places, but being in a rural area that's primarily agricultural, the problem isn't necessarily always access to food. It's the types of food that their providers are asking them to start eliminating, like for example, white rice, and if you can get brown rice or white bread to like more whole grain. They don't have access to that, one, because there's not always supermarkets. Sometimes they have more corner stores, and you're pretty limited to what you have access to in these various corner stores. Also, it costs a lot of money, and not everybody has very few people have full-time jobs. It can be much more like similar in some ways to like a gig economy in different places. And so just like the ability to get the food and then your ability to actually adhere to various recommended changes in food. And then sometimes the question is more so like, can they reduce, for example, the amount of food you eat? So instead of eating a lot of rice, maybe cut that a little bit over time. That might be helpful. But it is a little different in some ways, but it's about the types of the food variety that they have access to, and it's a little bit limited because of supermarkets versus corner stores and like open air markets and stuff.
Right. Thanks, Trishira. That's really interesting. Thank you for your great presentation.
Thank you.
So we'll move out to our last speaker, who is Margot Wettendorf. So Margot is in the Department of Cell Biology and Physiology in the School of Medicine. She's also a recipient of the American Heart Association Postdoctoral Fellowship. Margot earned her doctorate degree from the Baylor College of Medicine. At UNC, Margot's focused her research on molecular factors that affect pregnancy success, including embryo implantation and the development of a healthy placenta. And Margot investigates the effect of environmental factors such as e-cigarette exposure on fertility and reproductive fitness of future offspring. And so she will be talking more about that in her talk today. Margot?
Thank you so much, Joyce, for the introduction. Let me make this a show. Okay, there we go. And I just wanna take the time just to thank you for this prestigious award. It's truly been an honor to be a postdoc at UNC. There's so many different collaborations as well as projects and just opportunities. And I'm gonna describe one opportunity today that I had with the Center for Tobacco Regulatory Science and Lung Health. It was actually a pilot project where we received funding to examine e-cigarette exposure and fertility and reproductive fitness. So e-cigarette usage is on the rise right now with upwards of 900% increase of high school students using e-cigarettes. And these data points are a little old, but you can get the feeling that they're very popular right now. And when I think about high schoolers using e-cigarettes, I also think about reproductive aged women using these devices, as well as pregnant women, and how dangerous that could be with our limited knowledge. So what is known currently about e-cigarettes and pregnancy? Well, there's very little known about how e-cigarettes may affect a pregnancy. There's some in vitro data performed in cell culture of placental trophoblast cells that suggests that e-cigarette juices may impair function. However, there's more literature describing how e-cigarettes can actually affect the fetus in utero. And there's many studies, including mouse studies, showing metabolic changes as well as epigenetic modifications, behavioral abnormalities, and effects in postnatal lung development that could be detrimental to the fetus. And when we query for reproductive effects in the literature, we actually find nothing. And so this was really exciting to us that we could explore this for the first time to really examine how e-cigarettes could affect fertility. And so we proposed this hypothesis that e-cigarette usage would impair fertility and reproductive fitness of the future offspring. And in order to test this hypothesis, our approach was to expose pregnant wild-type C57 mice to e-cigarette vapor. And in order to do this, we actually used a Cyrec inexposed chamber where we place mice in these individual house compartments here and we expose them to primary e-cigarette vapor. So I first performed a fertility trial for 4 months on females. And I found kind of a varying degree of pups that were produced per female. So here in the e-cigarette exposed group, we actually had one female over the course of these 4 months that failed to produce any pups whatsoever. which was very striking. But then we also had one female that produced similar pup numbers compared to the sham group. However, then we found about three females that produced lower numbers compared to the sham group. So we could say that e-cigarettes may reduce pup number over time, but because of the individual variability that we see between mice, we can't make any strong significant conclusions regarding pup number per female. However, we were able to identify that the e-cigarette exposed mice exhibited a delay in the onset to their first litter. So that suggests that a litter is delivered 3 to 4 days after the sham exposed mice. And so that was particularly concerning, and it shows that there is a significant delay in pregnancy. Now, where that delay is occurring, we were unsure. It could be an implantation, it could be in fertilization, or maybe even in the development of the placenta. So we went back to implantation, which occurs at day 4.5 in the mouse. And here we're looking at day 5.5. So at this time point, all the embryos should be implanted into the uterus. And we should find here, like we examine in the sham exposed mice, this beautiful embryo that's implanted into the uterus. And we see what we call a decidual response, where this beautiful organization of these stromal cells surrounding the growing embryo. However, in the e-cig exposed mice, we found this abnormal looking embryo with blood cells present and extremely disorganized stroma surrounding this embryo. And in fact, when we look at 4 mice per group that were pregnant mice validated by hormone levels, we found upwards of 30 embryos in the sham exposed group and only 1 embryo in the e-cig exposed group, this embryo that I'm showing here. And so we can conclude that e-cigarette exposure delays implantation. However, what's interesting about these mice is that they're completely fertile. So we see a significant delay in implantation that even at day 5.5, when all the embryos should be implanted, these mice have not implanted embryos. And so this was actually the end of our implantation studies. And we are, for this pilot project, we are thinking about restarting these studies as we haven't really examined the full mechanism of why, where these embryos are and why implantation is delayed. But I will also go into what we looked at in utero exposure of these animals. And so we actually exposed in utero the mice as we did with the fertility trial. We took the male and female animals and we aged them and mated them to examine their reproductive fitness, and found that there were very modest effects, that they didn't have much of a change in reproductive fitness. However, what we did find significant was that e-cig exposed females exhibited lower total body weights at 6 months of age. And we can see also the males that were exposed to e-cig in utero also exhibited a decrease, however, it was not significant. And when we look at these females, we find that the inguinal fat pads are actually smaller in the e-cig exposed animals with smaller adipocytes. And so what we can conclude here is that e-cigarette exposure in utero can actually have long-lasting implications for metabolism. And many things that we haven't, this is just one of the things that we looked at. There could be many changes, epigenetic and metabolic, that we are unsure of. So the conclusions that I've shown you today is that e-cigarette exposure delays implantation. It also causes reduced weight gain in females. And obviously we would recommend that women that are considering using e-cigs during pregnancy, that they should take tremendous caution, as we can see it can have detrimental effects. So as I mentioned earlier, this paper, I published it last year, and it was the first to examine e-cigarette exposure in fertility. And so it was actually picked up by various news outlets, including the Endocrine Society, Yahoo Finance, Bustle, Vice, CNET, as well as Daily Mail UK, Business Standard, and Women's Health. So it was a very popular article, but it was exciting to really show the first effects of e-cigarettes on reproduction. So with that, I'd like to thank my laboratory, as well as my supervisor, Kathleen, and my collaborators and TCORS for the funding. Thank you.
Thanks, Margot. Again, feel free to type in your questions in the Q&A box, but I will get us started on the questions. So Margot, have you conducted work to assess the molecular mechanisms of the e-cig exposure? So for instance, is there any connection to adrenal modulin, which I know is also studied in your lab and also by you?
Yes, so well, That's interesting, because this was not about a train measurement at all. But cigarette smoke in general, we have shown to upregulate adrenomedulin in the placentas and in culture within placental trophoblast cells. E-cigarettes has the same effect, at least the ones that I have looked at, which also had a flavoring in them, which could make these studies have no flavorants added. And so that can cause numerous other issues and problems and health implications, of which we haven't examined yet. But yes, in culture, we have shown that e-cigarettes promote adrenomedulin. I have not yet looked at the placentas of e-cigarette exposed mice. And so very well, e-cigarettes may promote adrenomedulin in the placenta. And I would actually expect that, but we just haven't examined it, although we have plans to potentially pursue those studies.
Yeah, great, interesting. Okay, and then I'll just add one more question, and then we can, and I think we'll wrap up. And that is, so how does the exposure that you're, you know, putting on to the animals and mice compare to the type of exposure that one would get if you're just, you know, as a human smoking these e-cigarettes? Is it, you know, is it comparable, or is it possible to measure that difference?
Yes, that's the million-dollar question too, and it's a hard question. And we actually utilized this protocol from a lab that was studying lung health, lung development, and had this vaping protocol working. And we did not measure cotinine levels, which is the active measurement, the byproduct of nicotine that we can measure in the blood. So we do not have those levels directly to show, oh, this is comparable to the average vaping user. But what's also of concern is that there is such a wide variety of users for e-cigarettes. So you could have somebody that maybe they use e-cigarettes occasionally, maybe one puff a day, or you have those heavy users that may take in 200 to 300 puffs per day. And so their nicotine load is going to be a lot different. And so it's hard when we do these studies, because we're trying to find a middle ground, but it's very difficult to really state what's normal, what's average, because we have such a gradient of use. And then also with the fact that e-cigarettes can be modified, where you can add in your own nicotine levels, you can add in your own flavorings, the sky's the limit and what people can do with their vape device. So we have not yet looked at cotinine levels. Those are also, if we continue these studies, that is definitely planned to see how they measure compared to an average e-cigarette user. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco. So that wraps up the presentations from our PAR Award winners. I just wanted to send out some thank yous. One is to Mark Heise, who chairs the PAR committee, selection committee, and also to the faculty who served on the committee, selection committee this year to select our winners. Also wanted to thank Heather Ingram, who has been instrumental in organizing the applications and also organizing the PAR selection committee. And lastly, I just wanted to again congratulate and thank our PAR Award winners, Catherine, Carell, Zhuzhang, Dashira, and Margot, for their wonderful presentations and for all the great work they're doing here at UNC. All right, thanks everyone. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.